Hey there, comics crypto critters! Today's guest is an incredibly talented writer and director whose film The Sandlot has become one of the most admired and nostalgic films about childhood, friendships, and overcoming your fears. With its timeless quotes and wonderful performances, The Sandlot has secured its place in pop culture history. With an original prop from the film now on Golden Auctions, we will deep dive into the ins and outs of one of our most beloved films. Please welcome to the podcast, David Mickey Evans.
Hey!
Your opening is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was actually created by Kevin. Yeah, oh, Kevin created it. Yeah.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah. Music by Nine Finger, though. That's a great band.
Yeah, huge shout to Nine Finger. They created the opening song for the Comics and Crypto podcast. Big shout to them.
Dude. It's just it's just shades of Wayne's World, man.
I'm so excited to have you on today. This is going to be such a fun conversation. David, you know, we like to start off the podcast with a collecting question. Are you a collector? And if so, what do you collect?
Oh man. Well, back in the days, I used to collect Porsches.
Wow.
And then. Wow. You know, I had a fourth kid, and that hobby went away.
Oh, no.
That was back in the day, man. That was back in the day. Now I'm looking up in one of my shelves. I've got, if I had to guess, maybe like 100 signed balls, something like that.
Amazing.
You know,
all the places that I've gone with the movie and people give them to me. I've got this. And this is one of the coolest things is like, where are you guys? Kind of hard. It's a 55 Yankees ball.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Everybody's on there. And in 2013, when I went back to the Sandlot in outside Salt Lake City, Utah, they had a big showing and all this stuff. And a gentleman came up. He was a local dentist, doctor, something like that. Nice guy. Kel, his name was, and he says, you know, my dad gave me this when I was like 13, and I feel like you should have it. It was one of the hardest things I ever accepted. You know, like, what do you say? You know, thank you.
Yeah. Like,
but I told him I'd take care of it forever, man. And wow.
Absolutely.
I got lots of things like that, you know, but I'm not really a guy who, you know, signs on and buys and sells and stuff like that. But I've got, you know, I've got every Sandlot thing you can possibly imagine, you know, from, you know, Funko Pop dudes to, you know, Benny's jersey to, you know, Squints' glasses, you know.
Oh, you have Squints' glasses? I remember watching the other day I was watching the interview, or there's the anniversary of you guys going back there. I think it was about 10 years ago. And I think he mentioned, I wish I had those glasses still. Now we know who has them.
They're like priceless, those glasses, man.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
I do, because of my movie career and television career, I have a lot of cool stuff that I have collected, but I don't think in the sense, because I can see you guys are probably big time collectors. And so, no, I'm like T-ball compared to you.
Do you still have the baseballs from the movie, like the one signed by the Yankees? That Mr. Myrtle gave him, or do you have the Babe Ruth ball?
My prop guy has all those under lock and key.
I'm so happy to hear that. So it's still in your guys' possession.
Yeah, those are.
Oh, that's great. Yes. I'm so happy to hear that.
We got those. He's got, I'm not sure, but I think he has Benny's shoes, the PF Flyers.
Ooh, nice.
That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, I've got there's been a few, because during that time in 2013, I think it was between 2013 and 2018, PF Flyers reissued their original cool shoe, the one that was Benny was wearing, but on the inside they made it a Sandlot version, you know.
They
call the thing the footbed where you can take it out, you know, the thing. Well, if you look at it, it's actually a picture of the dirt on one of the baselines of the sandlot.
Oh, what? Yeah.
That's crazy. If you look inside, there's a little tag in there that says the secret weapon.
Oh, nice. Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Those are cool. Cool stuff. But my brother, actually, we collected football and baseball cards when we were kids, and he's got those shoe boxes full, and they literally are shoe boxes full of stuff. I haven't seen those in 100 years, though.
Oh, wow, that's incredible. I know you once mentioned that the movie arrived at the right time, right at the heart of the VHS blockbuster video era. And actually, coincidentally, I actually bought this about a week before I contacted you, and I got this in the mail, and it's a Blockbuster previously owned tape of The Sandlot.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I was so proud to get this. I saw it and I was like, I have to have that. It's incredible. Yeah.
Hold on one second. I'm going to duck out. Don't go away. I have a couple of these, which is the original.
Oh,
That's
amazing.
Wow.
I've got a couple of these, and I've got a couple of laser discs. Those are kind of rare.
You have laser discs. That's so cool. Yeah, it's wild, David. I don't know if you know, but the VHS market, it's a real thing. I mean, they're grading they're grading these VHS tapes now, and there's tapes that have sold for over $100,000, tens of thousands of dollars. It's a big deal.
Movie.
Well, the record right now is the 1982 Star Wars first commercial release tape, and that sold for $114,000. But we've seen like the Goonies sell for $50,000, Back to the Future sold for $75,000. This is a real market now.
No clue. Yeah. I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So keep that sealed tape nearby.
keep it safe. Maybe put that Jan Hancock on too, huh?
Yeah. Fire if it goes for over 100 grand.
I love it. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you today, and especially, you know, about The Sandlot, which is a film that's been so sentimental to our family and to all of our friends. It's a film we watch every year. I guess we can just kind of take a step back and help our audience get an understanding of how was The Sandlot created? Like, what was the inspiration behind it?
My little brother, when we were about, I don't know, maybe 10 and 8, he was 2 years younger than me, we lived in the northern San Fernando Valley in a little city called Pacoima, which is in L.A. County, but not L.A. City, you know. And that was in the early 70s, mid-70s kind of thing, to the late 70s, so we moved again. And we moved into that area at the end of something called White Flight, out of that area. So we ended up being these couple little white kids in an all sort of Chicano neighborhood and stuff. And nobody liked us, you know, and the kids on the street they were all sports oriented. You know, we didn't really know that much about sports. We knew baseball, football were, but we never had a dad that sort of, you know, taught us that stuff, you know? So we were behind the ball anyway. But anyway, my brother goes down there at the end of the block one day, and they'd never let us play with them. We never got picked for teams, nothing, not even last, just not picked. He went down there without me for some reason, and they had hit a ball over this notorious backyard wall that was on a corner lot. And in the backyard, there literally was an ill-treated dog, kind of a big shepherd mix called Hercules. And he was chained to this laundry thing, you know, a pipe with hands where you put your laundry. And they told my little brother, go over there and get that ball. Cause in those days you had one ball. You didn't have a bucket of balls.
Yeah.
They told him, go get the ball and you can play with us. So, you know, that was, you know, he couldn't resist that. So he went over there and he got the ball, but the dog broke that chain and ripped his leg all. It was terrible. Oh. And everybody laughed at him and all this. And so I was on many, many years later, I was driving up the 405 freeway in Los Angeles, trying to go about 22 miles to home. And it took me 3 hours and 45 minutes. That's what the traffic is like in LA. I remembered that incident, you know, and this was not too long after I had been unsummarily ceremoniously fired off my first studio script that I sold, Radio Flyer, which was
Great film.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And I thought I had been fired. You know, everybody in Hollywood gets a second chance, but nobody gets a third chance. So that occurred to me as I was driving home. I go, man, that's a good idea for a movie. A bunch of kids, summer, they've got one ball and they knock it and they got to get it back from the big bad dog. That's it. But by the time I got home, I wrote the first page of the script, and it was just a paragraph that described each character that I saw in my head. But I turned all those guys who were bullies in our childhood, I just made them all heroes. You know, I just flipped it on its back, because I thought it was a good idea for a movie, but I didn't want to see a movie about a bunch of bullies. I mean, yeah. You know, who wants to see that? So it ended up being really professionally terrific, but personally terrific as well. It was a bit of a catharsis. So that's how it came about.
Oh, that's awesome. I love the fact that it was actually the full, like, real inspiration with the dog and everything.
Yeah. My little bro, I'm trying to see if I got stuff all over the walls here, but I'm
okay. Your brother okay?
He's doing fine.
We too. We call him, in reference to the Sandlot, it's like without him, there probably would be no Sandlot. So we call him, he's the legendary kid that went over the fence.
That's awesome.
It wasn't as if
he's the original Benny.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You know, it's. It wasn't because he was super brave, man. He just wanted to play, you know, and you think about it in a kid's world, in a kid's mind, when you were that young and stuff like that, you know, today it's, oh, I paid my mortgage off. That's fantastic. Back then it's, you know, I get to play, you know, I'll do anything. So
that's awesome. Where
a lot of the heart comes from, you know?
Yeah. I love that.
So there's a lot of great scenes from this movie that we love, like deeply into our souls. But what is one of your favorite scenes from the movie?
Oh, man. That's always a weird question to answer, because it's like, as a director, I can say, well, you know, shooting this scene was a ton of fun, or this one was really difficult, or there's that way to come at it. But just like if I just take myself out of it as much as I can, I know that's impossible. Yeah. But, I mean, you're killing me, Smalls thing, the carnival I love, Wendy Peppercorn's got to be almost number one. But really, my favorite scene is the nighttime baseball scene.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, you know, I mean, many, many, many years later, this is probably, I think it was about 5 years ago or something like that, Bleacher Seats, Sports Illustrated, all these sorts of big ESPN. All have these contests every year. Best baseball movie ever made, best whatever movie. And The Sandlot has sort of consistently been number one or two over the last, since they started doing it, you know. And there was another something like that, and it was, what is the most American movie ever made? Not the best movie ever made in America. The actual words, the most American movie ever made, and The Sandlot won.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about it, and I go, that's it. It's that scene, man. Yeah. I mean, when I wrote that, what is it Billy Wilder said? He goes, cinematic subtlety is fine as long as it's obvious.
Yeah.
Okay. And that nighttime scene, I think we did a really good job on it. And it, man, we shot it in a few hours. You know, all kids, at that time of the year in Salt Lake City, it doesn't get dark till like 10:30 p.m.
Oh, but
can't work past like 11:30, you know?
Wow.
And we just scrambled and we got it done. And it came out very simple. There's no digi, nothing in there. It's all old school effects and stuff, all lights and gels. And then we put that Ray Charles song to it. And
I love
you
that.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I just did it.
It's so beautiful.
I mean, you get arguments about it, but I don't know if there's a more American song than Ray Charles.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. A purple mountain majesties
above the fruited plain. But now, wait a minute. I'm talking about America. America, you know, I mean, look, The Sandlot is not my childhood. It's the way I wanted my childhood to be, right? And that fireworks scene was sort of the whole, it was buttoning up, you know, every wonderful, awe-inspiring, cool moment that my brother and I had as little kids, of which there were not tons, you know? So yeah, that's gotta be it, I think.
And that lead up scene, we're seeing Hamilton running through the families in the block party. He's grabbing all the hot dogs. We're playing baseball, guys. That shows their love for the game. It was so cool. So pure.
I remember telling everybody was, you know, we're going to do this. That was a big deal. We're running out of light, you know, it was the end of the day. And all the guys, you know, directing them is like herding squirrels, man. But, you know, then but that's okay, you know. And I told Hamza, what do I do? What do I do, Pat? And he says, go stand in that thing. And when you hear me say, go, go. And I go, well, what do I do? Run down all those tables and make a hot dog. No, and he did. You know, but
you did a great job.
So natural.
They just became, I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, after a while making the movie, as we're shooting it, they became the characters.
Yeah.
But, you know, in retrospect, I know hindsight's 20/20, but I've seen this movie more than anybody in the world. And I think it isn't just that they became their characters. Their characters became them. Because what you see in that movie, those guys really were like that, you know? I mean, the worst thing you can do is, you know, take a kid, a young actor, and say, you know, here's Shakespeare, you're on in 5 minutes. Yeah. You know, you got to let him be and let him do. And it gets dialed in pretty quick, you know, if you've done it before. You understand their personality. Like, for instance, Pat Renna, he was always my go-to, you know. Like, if I go, oh, man, I don't know how to get out of this scene. You know, I look at the DP and he goes, cut to Ham. You know, well, cut to Ham doing something. Always say to Pat, I go, Pat, here's A, B, C, and E, U, B, D, whatever that is. Okay. You know, and he figures something out. And the rest of them as well, you know. And it was always like herding cats or squirrels. But once as a director, you get your mind around each of those little personalities, right? And you just got to stay wide awake for any second that you can go, oh, yeah, yeah, Marty York makes that funny laugh thing. That, oh, yeah. Oh, oh. He was doing it, telling a joke off set to somebody. And I go, come here, man. And he goes, what? And I said, what was that? And he did it again. And I go, okay, well, we're going to do that in the scene. So I grabbed everything from those guys that I could, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And then the other thing you can do with the child, I'm probably going to talk myself out of a job here, but you know, a lot of the times, like especially during the all the stuff when they're trying to get the ball back, the retrieval montage, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was written like, you know, they go up into the thing and they try with some erector set. You know, there was no dialogue in it ever anywhere, you know? And so I got the sound guy to give me some little bugs and I stuck them in their off-camera ears, you know, whichever side you want, so you couldn't see them. And I had a microphone and we'd run that thing where until we dialed in all of the action. I go, okay, you jump, you just do the, but I could at any time I could say, Chauncey, say this. And he would say it like squint, nice. You know?
Yeah.
And like that entire scene when Ham is bad mouthing the little league team. Yeah. Dude, I am literally standing like 5 feet from that guy right beside the camera going, you know, tell him you, if my dog was as ugly, blah, 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 you know?
Watch it, jerk.
Shut up, idiot. Moron.
Scab eater. Butt sniffer. Pus licker. Fart smeller.
You eat dog crap for breakfast, geek.
You mixed your weeds with your mama's toe jam.
Yeah!
You bob for apples in the toilet, and you like it.
You play ball like a girl!
The thing I found with young actors is the first, you know, if you give it to them and go, man, the first or second time they do it, it's gold. It's just, it's unrehearsed. It's just there. And the more they keep trying to do it, then it seems like they're reading it, trying to throw some spin on it, blah, blah, blah. I learned a lot of valuable lessons about young actors on that show. Yeah. Seems to work out pretty good.
I love that you said that the characters became the kids, you know, that it became part of them. I know that Shane Obazinski, who played Tommy Repeat Timmons, said that filming this movie was the greatest summer of his life.
Yeah.
You know, and it shows the chemistry. The chemistry is the one thing that really stood out the most. I mean, it was obviously how authentic that everything was, but the chemistry between the kids was incredible. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I thank you. And I think you're absolutely right. And look, I think I had him out there about 3 weeks, maybe about 3 weeks before we started shooting. As we were closing up pre-production, we brought them all out. I put them all in the same hotel. They went everywhere together in the van, you know, to the movies, to go-kart racing, whatever they were doing. And I said, look, you guys got to be buddies, you know, so go do stuff. So they did.
Okay.
And just like on screen, what I found was that they all in real life, as becoming friends, going to do stuff, the hierarchy of them as a group worked out in real life exactly the same way as it was on screen. And he was kind of like the mature, responsible, cool dude that everybody wanted to be like, you know. And he had all these guys under his wing. He really was like that, you know. And Pat, I mean, they're all self-sufficient, you know, but you know, they all looked up to Benny or to Mike. And everybody thought, you know, Chauncey was absolutely hysterical, which he was, you know. But when we were making the movie, if you'd have looked at them in their costumes on the Sandlot and then in their street clothes as real kids going to the movies, you never would have known it. I mean, you know, Chauncey had, I can't remember what you call them, those jeans. It was like 17 cubic yards of material, you know, these jeans. And he had those on and, you know, the hat turned sideways. And he was, I guess in the early 90s, he was a 13-year-old player, if you will. So he was not a goofy kid, you know. And he was good, and he's still good. You know, we're all still buddies. In fact, I'm bringing them all down to my neck of the woods to do a screening for charity in December.
That's amazing. Awesome. Yeah, and it's so good to hear how close they still are. They said they still talk weekly. That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They go all together or in chunks to all kinds of signings, Comic Cons. Everything all over the place. They're, you know, they've got stuff booked out through next year, I'm sure. Yeah. But this one was just for my little hometown for a charity that helps out kids, underprivileged kids with sports and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, they're coming down. It's going to, I'll have to herd them again.
Or at least their kids.
You got some kids, yeah. They're all really, really solid, good dudes, though. They really are.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
It's cool. Well, I mean, speaking of like all the lines, we all have our favorite lines that we quote constantly in our in our life. Yeah. I mean, "You're Killing Me, Smalls" is one that we used consistently. Yeah. I'm curious, what was your favorite line out of the whole movie?
Yeah, when the producer said, "Here's your paycheck." No, I'm just kidding. No. That is a really good question. Listen, I love "You're Killing Me, Smalls," and I could tell you 100 stories about hearing that out in the world, all over the world, man. You know, Japan, in English, you know, and it just became this thing. And the original in the script, it doesn't say "You're killing me, Smalls." It says "You kill me, Smalls," and it's really different. You know, it doesn't seem ing doesn't seem like a big deal, but it was. And the first time Pat ever said it, he botched it. He said, "You're killing me, Smalls," right? And everybody cracked up. And then I learned a really valuable lesson as a writer that day.
Yep.
If it works better, let him do it and take credit for it. You know. So, and I gotta tell you, listen, in my recollect, that I think Bob Gunner, who was the co-writer on, I'm pretty sure he came up with that line. So we put it in a few more places. But then when Pat you know, said it, and everybody cracked up. We put it in a few more places because, you know, it's good stuff, you know. So yeah, I love that one. Probably heroes get remember, kid. Heroes get remembered, but legends never die. Love Paul Young. You never go wrong.
I'll see you later. Remember, kid. There's heroes and there's legends. Heroes get remembered, but legends never die. Follow your heart, kid. You never go wrong.
I've met a, you know, a ton of sports stars and players and stuff in my life, but I never met Kobe, which I wish I had met him. But he used it all the time on his Twitter and his texting and all kinds of stuff. You know, legends never die, man. And the 4th of July at his house, all his kids and all their friends would come over and they only watch one movie, you know. There's that. It's been used many, many times. You've heard, you know, I think I heard Derek Jeter say it, you know, Aaron Judge, all the, you know, they love it. Yeah. I remember writing it and looking at it and I go, man, that is really cool. Does it make any sense? You know, it took me a long time to wrap my head around, because it happens sometimes you go this and you go, what the hell does that mean? Yeah. You're trying to say something. And after a while, it carried all this meaning that I hadn't thought of, or maybe it was subconscious, I don't know, into it. So, and I think it's the point of the movie too. The movie's not a baseball movie. It's a movie about friendship, right? Yeah. And when you're a kid, you know, you jump over a backyard fence to pickle a dog that has been known to consume children, you know, and you get that ball, and that guy chases you all over town, and you go, blah, blah, blah. You're not a hero, man. You're a certified legend. It's you, you know, Daniel Boone and Babe Ruth, you know, that kind of thing. But it's on this kid, you know, micro level, right? And with their kind of imagination and the way they see the world, the way they experience stuff. So yeah, I liked it a lot, and it's still my favorite one. Yeah.
And I love that you brought up the theme of friendship. You know, the movie explores a lot of universal themes, like friendship and teamwork, acceptance, and the challenges of growing up. As the co-writer, were there any important messages that you hoped would resonate with the audience specifically?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. You know, sometimes you start out with a piece and you want to, I don't know, it could be anything, an apophthegm, a saying, a this or that. You know, you go, I'm going to explore this and see if I can prove it or whatever. Is that true? The thing with the Sandlot is it Dick Donner told me this once, the God rest his soul, the director of the Lethal Weapon movies and the original Superman and such. Right. Mm-hmm. And he was just the greatest guy I ever met. I mean, he was just a mensch, took me under his wing, helped me out a lot. And he said, we were talking about Radio Flyer, 'cause he directed Radio Flyer after I got fired, you know?
Yeah.
And he was $1 billion director. I was nobody, you know, but he helped me. And he said, kid, after this movie comes out, you're going to see in the paper that you're not going to believe, you know, oh, Bobby was Christ. All, he gave me all these examples, you know, and he goes, listen, I'm still getting it on Superman. You know, there's these reviewers that say I did a blatant Christian movie and he brings somebody back from the dead and it's Jesus Christ, on and on and on. And I'm looking at him, are you kidding me? You know, he goes, no, man, it's going to happen. And he was right. You know, there's all, it's overlay, right? Human beings like to, you got all the stuff and that's in here. You are your experience, your nature, your nurture. And then, you know, let me put that on top of something and see if it works. I don't do that. I mean, I don't know very many writers that do. Nonetheless, you know, semiology being what it is, it's in there. You know, it really is in there. And what I was thinking about when I was writing the movie was, you know, I would never want in a trillion lifetimes want to go through the childhood that I had, you know, but you know, I'm a writer, so I have a time machine, you know, pencil and a paper, you know, or keyboard. And I'm going to make this the way I wanted it to be. And when somebody sees it, I hope, it, you know, hey, is there anything more important in life than a friend you can depend on? Right? Is that your wife, your husband, your partner, your what? Your when you were a kid, that great the great movie Rob Reiner did Stand By Me. At the end of the movie, right? He says, I never again in my life had friends like I did when I was 12. And he goes, Jesus, does anybody? You know, I don't know. I got some pretty good friends now. And I got maybe two from back in the day that I still know, or even from high school, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, I know what happens to people when their childhoods, what was it? They asked Hemingway, what does it take to be a great writer? He goes, an unhappy childhood. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I don't consider myself a great writer at all. But the point is, you know, if The Sandlot ever did anything to help one kid not get his butt kicked, right? Or one guy like a Benny, who was hesitating about going, hey, come here, new kid in the school, you know, I'll be your buddy, then it was worth it, you know? Yeah. So I think that's about as deep as it went. I mean, that's as deep as you'd like, you know? I mean, you can go down that rabbit hole forever. But, and I think, and I've had firsthand evidence of people coming up to me, you know? I mean, listen, I'll tell you, you guys got you got a minute, I'll tell you a little story about 2000. No, I was just back for the 30th anniversary. They had a big deal with three big blow-up screens and stuff, and was there all day on the actual land we shot Sandlot on. Big celebration, thousands of people. The mayor made, I can't remember, August 14th, I think, is now officially, forever, Sandlot Day in Salt Lake City.
Yes.
Oh, you know, wow.
Love it.
We got our own day, boys. You know, that's a really good.
Put that on the calendar.
And well, back in it was the 25th, I think, they put up a titanium plaque on a granite pedestal, you know, it's like, you know, that says this is where it was and all this. And I've had thousands and thousands of people tell me how much the movie means to them, but I'd never heard this, and it kind of answers what you said. There's a young lady, let's call her in her early 20s. And her mom, and guys, this is like probably 10 o'clock at night. And this started at, you know, probably 6 a.m. the day before.
Oh, wow.
Nobody would leave. Nobody wanted to leave sacred land, you know, and they were watching the movie, and they waited for me at the entrance. And this young lady says, Mr. Evans, she wanted me to sign something. So I did. And she goes, well, I have to tell you something. She starts to cry. And I'm like looking at the mom like, what's happening? You know, it's just, no, I have to tell you something. She says, my original dad, my blood dad, was very bad to me, right? And my stepfather, I thought, was just going to be just like him and all this stuff. So I always had this defensive thing about him. She's crying a lot, you know. She went way, way deeper and more personal than I'm telling you. And when I saw this movie, and how Scotty and his stepdad work out, it gave me the courage to let him love me, you know?
Wow.
And I loved him and blah, blah, blah. And oh my God, I had to sit down and it was, I've never heard that before, you know? But I've heard so many things like that, that I guess it has that positive cathartic effect on people, you know, the picture.
It definitely does. I mean, especially for me, I mean, seeing how Benny treated Smalls, you know, this new kid in town that no one gave a chance, but he gave him a chance and really fought for him.
Yeah.
And the kids listened and he ended up working out in the best way. And for me, that had a profound impact on me growing up and the way I thought about friendship.
Yeah.
So for me personally, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. It helped me too, man. I remember when I went to great school in the LAUSD, the Los Angeles Unified School District, you know, and but in those days, man, in the early 70s in grade school, it was as much as it as much as it gets, kids have to deal with it online these days, you know, and it comes from, you know, they're never without it. It was like, you know, in those days, if you were going to get bullied, it was on the way to school, on the way home from school, and definitely at school. That's where it was. And it was particularly harsh in those days. I don't know why, but it was. Thank God nobody had the internet in those days, you know, because, yeah. My God, bullies would have taken over the world, you know, think about it. So anyway, yeah, I'm glad it had that thing. And then there's other stories like, you know, that's a really super deep emotional one. One time I'm walking through the Denver airport, and there's this dad coming at me. He's, I don't know, 30. And he's got this squirrely little toddler, skull and 3.5, you know, something like that. And the dad's got a backpack. He's towing a suitcase. The kid's got his little, you know, Disney backpack or whatever it was, you know, it's really big, but there's nothing heavy in it, so he can walk. And he is just like, just going ape, you know, going the biggest tantrum on planet Earth, you know. And this dad is, I can see he's coming right at me, you know, and I can see him. He's like looking for his plane and dragging the kid. And finally he just goes, and he drops all his shit. And now I'm about, you know, I'm about 6 feet from him now. And he just looks down at the kid and goes, "You're killing me, Smalls." Right. he was in a really exasperated way. That way I did, it sounded angry. And it wasn't like that. He was just like, "I give up," you know?
Yeah. Frustrated. Yeah.
It was it. He was going to make this connection flight. He was, you know what? Yeah. So, and I try never to do this, but I just couldn't resist, you know? I go, "Hey, man, how's it going?" And the guy just stares at me, right? We're in the middle of the airport. I go, "Look, you're not going to believe this, okay?" And I said, "But that, you know, you're killing me, Smalls. You said to your kid." He goes, "Yeah." I go, "It's from The Sandlot." He goes, "Yeah." I go, "I wrote that line." And he goes, "Yeah." And he tries to go away. And I go, "No, dude." And I took out my license and stuff. I go, "I am the director and the writer of that movie." Nice. And he looked at me like with, you know, big eyes, you know, those paintings. Oh, like, yeah. Cannot believe what is happening right now. And I go, "Listen." And I go, "Here's my email address. Email me and I'll send your boy some posters and stuff." Aww. And a t-shirt and all that.
Aww.
And you too. And it'll make this better. And he didn't. "Thank you." And I thought, well, I tried to do a nice thing. Maybe it was stupid. I don't know.
I love it.
Years later, I hear from this guy. He's, "Oh, my God. He's a pay student. He's this and that. Posters are up. You signed them. They're on the thing."
Oh, it's his, awesome.
His kid's favorite possession is this poster that was signed for him as he was a screaming, tantrum throwing. Oh. Damn, man, that is... That's, I'm putting that one in the CV, right? You know, I mean,
yeah. It's the one time rewarding bad behavior worked out.
Absolutely. Never thought of it that way, dude. That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Or, you know, you're a bad boy. You can have this when you're a good boy, you know?
Yeah. My dad uses that line weekly. I'm dead serious. Yeah. It's become part of his language now.
Oh dear. Oh well. Yeah, you know what? It's I just wish I had the merchandising on that movie, which I do not. Because that's a pretty popular t-shirt.
You still got all the original props?
Most of them, yeah. Some of them were destroyed in a fire. Rick Lazzarini from the character shop. Mm. It was in the creature shop. I can't remember. It might have been both. Anyway, I went to college with the guy. He was one of the best monster builders, you know, for Hollywood, special effects monsters and stuff. And he built all of the beast puppets for the movie. Nice. There was one that two guys got in. It was 6.5 feet tall. They walked around and there was a half head and a paw and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And all except the paw. It was in a Planet Hollywood somewhere, I think, yeah, in Orange County, California. And when they went kaput, I think it went, it might have went to either the Smithsonian or Cooperstown.
Nice.
Yeah. So that survives. And the head, you know, that grabs the ball, it's a big giant head.
Oh, yeah.
That was left in a corner and nobody knew it was there. Somebody found it a couple years ago and bought it and restored it.
Oh, so wow.
Yeah, it's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'd love to have that. Yeah. Yeah. But most of the other stuff, either I have, there have been a few pieces over the years that have been auctioned off, but most of it is either me or Terry Haskell, my prop master. He's got warehouses full of cool Sandlot stuff, you know?
That's so awesome. Most audiences didn't realize that you were the narrator of the Sandlot, which, by the way, you absolutely crushed
it. Yeah.
Absolutely crushed it.
Thank you very much.
Since this film was inspired from your childhood, did this ultimately lead to the decision for you to narrate the film?
No. Well, yes and no. Okay. Yeah. And this is how it went. The actor that plays the adult Scotty Smalls is Arliss Howard. He's an absolute, like, just a gem of a human being. Super smart. He's a fantastic actor. Look him up. He's done a million things. And he's a really nice guy. A really good dude. He's also got a bit of a drawl when he talks, like he's from Alabama or something like that.
Gotcha.
And so Scotty, the character, was not from the South. He was supposed to be from, well, out of town. But when we cast Tom Guyrie as Scotty Smalls, Scotty necessitated having to have come from Jersey because Scotty, he had a pretty pronounced Jersey accent, you know, Trenton or whatever. So we worked with Tom a little bit, and so that went away. It was still there a little bit, you know. So there's the thing. What would that guy sound like as an adult? Well, he's not going to sound like he moved to Alabama and suddenly has a Southern drawl, you know. So when we get into the recording booth with Arliss, he's laying down the tracks, and we're like, try it this way. Tried to me and my editor were there, Mike Stevenson. And he just didn't feel like he could get it. You know, and I said, well, he literally turned around and looks at me. He goes, Dave, I kind of brought a clarinet to this party. And if you need a trumpet, you got to get somebody else. And I go, you know, at least you're being honest, bro. You know, yeah. And so shook hands and Arliss took off. And I remember this. I looked at Mike and I said, What do we do now? You're like, what are we going to do, dude? And he goes, you go do it. And I said, go, you want me to go do it? And he goes, yeah, you wrote it just like you just said. And you know how to say it. And it's your story anyway, go do it. So I said, all right. So I went into the thing and we ran the movie maybe 1.5 times. And I laid it all down in 1 or 2 takes. And
Wow.
I was not a SAG member or anything like that. So I just never... It just never occurred to me to ask the studio for credit. It would now, you know, yeah. I promise you, but it just never occurred. And, you know, people seem to like it and it seemed so it worked pretty good.
I think the narration in the film is fantastic.
Yeah, it
feels authentic when you hear it. You're like, oh, this man lived this life.
Yeah.
I think it does that. It connects pretty much the tone and the cadence and the way that he's speaking. You don't have any doubt that it's the adult mind of that kid you're seeing on the screen, you know?
Exactly. One of my favorite moments in the film is the fact that at the end, James Earl Jones shows up as Mr. Myrtle. As a kid, like as a Star Wars fan too, I already knew who James Earl Jones was and all that. So when he showed up, I was like, what? Like that was one of the best twists for me at the end. How did you manage to get James Earl Jones?
I get lucky a lot. And Mr. Myrtle was not written with respect to any ethnicity, race, nothing. It was just Mr. Myrtle. So I didn't care. Yeah. And maybe into the second or third week, we didn't have an actor to play Mr. Myrtle, and it was coming up where we had to finish shooting stuff on the Sandlot. Mr. Myrtle's house is there. And so they're going through all these names, and my AD, Bill Elvin, God rest his soul, he's passed away. Bill says to me, you guys got to remember too, I was like 27 or 28 years old, and you know, all the everybody else was twice my age. And he says, well, you should get James Earl Jones to play that part. And I go, yeah, right. Like, I'm going to get Darth, you know, freaking Vader to play. Please let the
Field of Dreams.
Right. That, right. I'm like, Bill, let the people talk, you know? And Bill, seriously, you should get James Earl Jones. And I go, I'd love to have James Earl Jones. We'll never get him. He goes, hang on a second. He whips out his phone. He calls James Earl Jones because Bill was the AD on Field of Dreams.
Oh, there you go. Nice. Yes.
I said, what? And so he calls him and he says, let me send you the script. And he goes, I'd like to overnight him the script. They overnight him the script. And James called back the next day to Bill. And Bill goes, yeah, here, James wants to talk to you. So he says, and it was him. I mean, you know, on the phone, it's like, oh, you know, wow. And he says, Dave, this is a terrific script. I love it. And I would like to play this Mr. Myrtle, but I am black and I never would have, ages being what they are. It's 1962. If you reverse engineer it, I never would have played with Babe Ruth. I said, shit, that's right. You would have been in the Negro Leagues at that time, whatnot. And I said, all right, let me figure this out. You know, so that's how it became a thing where he knew Babe. And actually Babe Ruth, I found out years later, used to go barnstorming in the off season to earn money and stuff. But a lot of times he would go to the Midwest, Kansas City, where all these the Negro League players were. And he would play in some of those games against those guys. And they were all super good friends. And it was cool. So it was okay that Mr. Myrtle, Thelonious Myrtle, knew Babe Ruth and that they were buddies. It just couldn't be that they were, you know, in the same, playing in the same game. Gotcha. And I wrote a prequel to The Sandlot that we're going to do, Fox, Disney, that takes place in 1950, where you find out what Mr. Myrtle's entire story is, where the beast came from, like legit, right?
Wow.
And who actually built the Sandlot? Because the kids in 1962 didn't.
No.
They found it. It's a neighborhood relic, if you will, right? And they fixed it up a little bit, but it was really built in 1950. So having James Earl Jones play Mr. Myrtle in the original Sandlot gave me a giant chunk. In fact, the entire idea for the story of the prequel. And had it not been him, I don't think I would have thought that up, you know?
Oh, man. Oh, gosh. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
amazing. Everything's connecting, man. Everything connects, you know?
How's the development for that going?
Yeah.
Well, it was like they were, you know, the hand was over the green button. And then Disney bought Fox.
Oh, so it was when the merger happened.
Exactly. It was 2018, 2019. And so luckily enough, because I wrote we're doing a streaming series with Disney Plus, and that also got sold during that time, the acquisition. And those scripts, it's just this thing in Hollywood. When you have a script, it goes to someone at a studio, and that someone goes, this is great, we're going to make it. And then gets fired, or somebody buys the studio. The first thing usually that happens is they take a big bulldozer and knock everything off everybody's desk. It will never get made. And then you got to go try to get it in turnaround, buy it back. Decades of agony. Anyway, these two projects have survived.
Wow.
And they've not been knocked off the desks, right? And Disney Plus, which is the entity now that owns Fox, but Fox works with them, yada, yada, are the guys that have the say. And they, Disney Plus, since the time I sold the series to them, has gone through, I think, 5 CEOs. And that's in what?
Wow.
3 years, 4, 5 years, 5 and a half years. And, you know, it's just chaos and turmoil. But last week, a week and a half ago, my manager got a call and they want to go forward with the TV series. And
nice.
And
congratulations, David.
Oh, so dude.
I'm so excited.
I told him, look, amazing. You're not gonna let me make the prequel as a motion picture. Let me use it as the pilot for the street. You know? So nice. Cross your fingers, boys. I hope I
that. I would love to see it.
Yeah, me too.
I'd love it. I'd love to do that.
What was your favorite moment with James Earl Jones, by the way?
I have two.
Yes.
Okay. The first day he shows up, which was not long after I talked to him on the phone.
Oh, wow.
He, it's James Earl Jones. You know? Yeah. We don't have any movie stars. Well, Karen Allen, we had her for a couple
of years. She's great. She's on the
side. But he's like, oh my God, you know, who was not in love with Karen Allen or isn't in love with Karen Allen?
Yeah.
He shows up. And I don't know where he is. And Bill Elvin is his friend. He goes, gets him out of the transport car. And I walk over to Mr. Myrtle's house, and Bill is showing him, because he's Mr. Myrtle, here's the house, blah, blah. And I just sort of will stand to the side, and Bill sees me and goes, just one second. I'm like, cool. And so James Earl Jones says, Bill, where's the director? Well, I want to meet the director. And Bill goes, he's right here. And there I am. And I'm like, whatever I was, 27. And I looked a lot younger, probably. And James Earl Jones looks at me and goes, Bill, seriously, where's the director? Absolutely did not believe that I was the director.
Oh, no.
In any way, you know? And I went, oh, boy. You know, please don't let this be bad, you know? And I go, well, Mr. Jones, you know, I am the director, you know? And he's looking at me like, what? You know, he just couldn't believe it. And we shook hands. And then we were fast friends because I needed him for The Sandlot 2 years later. And it was just this tiny little thing. It was going to be in the end. I only needed him for a day, but it's a big deal. You know, he's getting towards 80. You know, he's got to fly and all this.
Yeah.
And they called him up and he goes, oh, for David? I'm done. Just, I'll be there. Don't worry. And wow. I was like, oh my God, you know, I must have been nice to him. You know, or something. You know, but the other one was, of course, all the guys who were 12, 11, 12, 13 at the time. It's Darth Vader, dude, you know? And they know he's CNN as well, right?
Oh, yeah. And
they're terrified to go up and say hello to him.
Oh, right? No.
And I'm thinking, as the director, you know, my real-life actors are scared of the guy playing the guy in the movie they're supposed to be scared of. It's going to happen, you know? But somehow, Marty York, he was a pretty scrappy kid, you know? He would go do stuff. He'd get into trouble. And he says, I'll do it. So Mr. Jones is sitting at one of the tables having lunch by himself. And Marty was like this big. He was a little dude. Walks right up to him and says, are you Darth Vader? And James turns to him and goes, no, I am your father.
So good.
I love this guy and I'm going to love him forever because that is. And then, you know, he got an autograph and all the other guys came over and he signed autographs and stuff. But the way I like to describe Mr. Jones, he's the most gracious man I've ever met. Absolutely.
Oh, that's so good.
He's a really good dude.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, there's some other off-color stories, but
that's okay.
See you later.
my favorite is when he's holding the ball. He's like, you're dead while you stand.
Won't sign this? Yeah. Oh, okay, he still's like,
that was my stepdad's ball. I took it without asking. It was signed by Babe Ruth.
George signed this?
George Herman Ruth? Yeah.
I take it back. You're not in trouble. You're dead where you stand.
then he takes that big gulp. Scotty's like, oh, God.
Yeah, he's like, oh, no, my life is over.
Yeah, my life is over, dude. It's true.
I love when he said that line, because I think he said it knowing he has a solution, and he has a solution.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think so, absolutely.
And
yeah.
He loves
yeah, he's like messing with him just a little
bit. Yeah.
Well, you got to, you know, you do something that dumb, man. You got to get it for a little while. You know?
I still love that moment where he goes, why didn't you just come over? I would have gotten it for you.
Sorry, any small.
But it makes sense for kids. Like, kids don't think that way. They go, these other pathways.
That's the point. It's a giant metaphor. Is when Benny jumps over that fence, he's taking his first step into the adult or the grown-up world. Responsibility, all this. It's, you know, my obligation, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then, if you really want to get all Roland Barthes about it, when that fence falls down, it's like, that's it. Childhood's over.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you got to go now. And that's why they all disappear in the end. You know, I mean, it's again, like that thing. Did you ever have friends like that again in life? You know, like you did when you were 12.
I know once you mentioned that the film is the one that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Why do you believe that this film continues to make such a deep impact on viewers?
I think everything that we've been talking about, the authenticity, I think is super, you know, authenticity is, it's weird. It's like, you look at a thing like The Sandlot, and I mean, you know, it's not like Kino Eye, super, you know, objective authenticity. I mean, it's super subjective. It's all out of my head. So yeah. But you look at it and it's a movie, yeah, but they're kind of behaving and acting and doing stuff that you did or kids do it at that age. They're speaking sort of like they did, and they get into this big trouble, and then they get out of it and stuff. Everybody's gone through that. You know, not getting a ball back, but whatever their retrieve the ball thing was, you know, the giant mistake you make we probably make lots of them, but you can. Just, I give you 3 seconds. Think of the biggest mistake you made when you were a kid. See, you already know. I know what mine was, you know.
Yeah.
So everybody has got that kind of thing. And it's honest, you know. I don't think I was trying to lie to anybody, you know, and be tricky or clever. Yeah, well, there's plenty of clever stuff in it, but it wasn't for clever's sake, you know. It meant something. It was serving a purpose. And then I think it's like, I don't care who you are or where you come from. In some way, you either were one of those kids, wanted to be one of those kids, or knew one of those kids. What did I say? You want to be, you knew one? Yeah. Or you wanted to be like that. And I've never met anybody that doesn't agree with that. So I think that's why it stays around. I mean, look. If you look at a movie, the only other movies that come close to The Sandlot are holiday movies. You know, Sandlot is Fox's number one. They call them evergreen films that continue to make more money in release this year than the year before, over and over and over and over again. So it's number one at Fox. It's probably coming if you don't count Disney's, you know, animation. Then it's probably at the top of Disney's as well. Meaning it keeps, when it comes by on Netflix, people watch it. They buy the DVD, they do. And it, you know, look, I get all the residuals, man. All you got to do is reverse engineer it. And you know how much money it's making. And it's amazing. You know, I mean, people have many, many copies of this. So anyway, the only other one that comes close to it is A Christmas Story.
Yeah,
it's a holiday film, and even though if you look at that film and it's sort of, I'm not going to call it high camp. There's a little bit of campy stuff in it, but really, that's a really authentic picture if you think about it.
Yeah,
nobody's doing anything that you guys and me didn't do, sticking your tongue against the cold pole. You know, want a BB gun, all that, you know, and how you. romanticized it and stuff. I mean, we did that. We all did that. You know? Yeah. We still do that. And I would call that, you know, a really authentic picture as well, but in a, but in a very different way than the,
yeah,
than the Sandlot, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's what keeps it going. And I think it, again, talking about the end, when Benny jumps over the thing, when Benny jumps over that fence, it says in the script, I wrote it, you know, there's no more monsters. There's no more, you know, giant whatever, you know, no, what's back here is 1,000 times worse. You know, it's a real dog, you know, and it's been cleaned up for 20 years and it's pissed, you know? Yeah. So that's like, you know, hello, grown up world, bring it on. And yeah, everybody has to go through that. You know, whether you're thinking that when you watch a movie or not, I think it gets you somewhere back here, you know? So I think that's it.
Yeah. Directors and writers dream of creating a multi-generational film like this.
Yeah.
You know, and congratulations, because this film is gonna last oh, yeah, forever.
My kids are gonna up with it.
My grandkids are gonna see it. I'm so excited. Yeah.
This is one of those things where it's like, you know, I have to literally put this in my will because it's not ever gonna go away, man.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's always going to play. So man, now I'm all stoked to go do that animated the streaming series and the
I'm so excited for you, David. It's that's amazing.
I want it. And
I hope so, man. I'm pretty stoked about it. So you know,
that's great. And this is actually a great transition to the item currently on Golden Auction.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So the actual photo that was used in the very beginning and the end, the closing shot of the Sandlot, still in the original frame, is currently on Golden Auctions. It ends on this Saturday. Wow, what a piece of history. I mean, this film and this photo and the letter that you wrote was so beautiful, by the way. I've read that like 10 times. It was so beautiful. And you've held on to this for almost 30 years. What made you decide to finally depart ways with it?
Well, I told you about I'm having a screening down here and I'm bringing like 5 of the guys down and all that. Yeah. And that's all to benefit, you know, charities and a couple of local charities here. And I got to thinking about it and, you know, I'm looking around my office walls. I have a painting, a fine art painting by the great fine artist, Madison Gregory, of that photo up on my wall. It's much bigger.
Wow.
And I've got, you know, like the Hambino, I got all the stuff. And I looked at this thing and I've had it and I thought, well, you know, somebody might be willing to pay a chunk of change for that. And since we're in the charity mode and it's this time of the year, and I go, all right, let's see, maybe we can help somebody out, you know?
That's awesome.
I talked to my brother about it because he's involved in it. And he said, go to Golden. And I really didn't know anything about who to go to or whatever. And so that's how it ended up on Golden. And like you said, as we were talking earlier, you know, we're 3 days out from the end and they got that extended bidding interval thing they do.
Yeah.
And it's like almost $2,000 right now. So, you know, I will consider it. I will consider if this thing, you know, gets into the 5 digits somewhere, you know, years ago, somebody offered me 6 digits for that and I didn't sell it.
Wow.
But I hope it makes enough so that I can, you know, give that's pretty much it.
That's amazing.
And I'm, you know, I'm pretty confident that anybody that ends up buying this is going to treasure it.
Absolutely.
As
you can see in the top, I've been outbid. I was a little bitter for about a day or two, but I knew it last.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. I was selfishly like, I want to advertise this, but I also don't want to advertise it.
I know. It's hard.
That's that, man.
But like you said, you know, I know whoever ends up buying this is going, it's going to hold a special place in their heart, and they're going to see the end of that film and then look over and see it on their wall, and that is going to be a special moment for them. So that's super cool. Yeah, my dad and I are crossing our fingers on Saturday, and hopefully we can. We're gonna be sitting next to each other in the extended bidding, and and go from there. But I'd be very surprised if this goes under 5 digits. I was telling him that. I don't think it's going to go under 5 digits, Dad.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so weird to try to predict it, you know?
I know. It's because it's all comes in right at the end. It's
Totally. I mean, yeah. I wish I'd have done it with a reserve and all that, but hey, man.
Yeah, all you need is two people who want it bad enough, and I'm not shocked that there's two people in this auction right now that want it bad enough.
Exactly.
That's so cool. And you took this photo.
I did. Yeah.
Do
we have enough time? You want me to read that? I'll read that.
That'd be amazing. Yeah.
All right, here we go. It's been said that the photo of the Sandlot Boys is the most beloved, iconic, famous photograph that's ever appeared in any motion picture. That it's mounted as a plaque and appears on screen at both the beginning and end of the Sandlot in the announcer's booth at Dodger Stadium makes its auction a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There's only one photo plaque of the Sandlot Boys used in the film, and this is it. I took the photo after the last take of the last shot of the last scene on the last day of production at the Sandlot in Glendale, Utah, near Salt Lake City. The boys didn't want that summer to end. You can see it in their faces, especially in their eyes and their poignant smiles and the way they're comporting themselves. They grew both as their characters that summer and as young men in the real world. And it shows in the photo. They've gained confidence. They've grown up. They've been through the adventure of a lifetime with no guarantee it was going to end well, but it did. I took the picture with a Hasselblad large format camera borrowed from my cinematographer, Anthony Richmond. It's a bittersweet moment that tells us they're more than a team now. They're the best buddies in the history of the world for life. That's what I wanted the photo to say. I wanted it to be a reminder of what's important in life. Friends you can count on. I've had this plaque in my office for more than 30 years as a constant reminder of what's good in the world. That's true, by the way. It's time for someone to whom the Sandlot means as much as it does to me to enjoy the daily dose of pure childhood mojo, the blissful nostalgia, and every time you look at the photo, the priceless peace of mind that all is right in the world, if only for just that moment. And it'll be that way forever because legends never die. Well, that's what goes with it. And I saw
it.
Yeah. This is the first on the podcast. I've never gotten emotional before. Thank you for doing that.
Well, that's what it is, right?
Now I'm empty my bank account.
I know. I'm like, Sean, how do we get this thing? What do we do?
He's 10 years later on Skid Row and he's got the plaque, you know?
Thank you so much for that. And everyone out there, if you want an opportunity to bid on this, it's currently on Golden Auction right now and ends this Saturday. So make sure to get in there and make the bids because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
If you don't, I'm swiping it up.
Oh, man.
All right. So I only have one last question for you, sir. Most important question.
Okay.
At the end of the film, we learned that Bertram got really into the 60s and nobody served from the States.
What happened to Bertram?
Guys, there's a lot of conjecture about that. Okay. And I've actually talked to Grant, the actor. We've had a lot of conversations because we end up at the same places at signings or whatever.
Yeah.
So me and all the guys, and Grant's one of the guys coming down here for my charity.
Nice.
And he wants to say, what in your head, what happened to him? And I'm like, man, I think we were right in that. You know, it was like Bertram, you know, he just seems like a guy who would have, you know, towards the end of the 60s when he's, you know, 20 years old, 18 years old, he just went to San Francisco, man. You know, he went to Haight-Ashbury, you know, and he probably got on the bus with Ken Kesey, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Merry Pranksters. You know, he probably lived this amazing life, hung around with Jim Croce and, you know, Andy Warhol, you know? He probably some kind of psychedelic shaman, you know? But I will tell you this. I can neither confirm nor deny, but I'm not quite so sure that he's met his final demise.
Gotcha.
We may actually find out the real answer to that question.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I'm excited to hear about his
his animal.
I'm excited to hear about his Forrest Gump adventures.
Oh, he's the real life Forrest Gump.
That's amazing.
Right? It's kind of, yeah. I think that's his life. He was kind of like that.
That. Great. That makes sense.
That's amazing. David, it was so amazing to have you on the podcast. I can't thank you enough. This is
You guys are the best, man. Anytime. Keep me up, like, you know, guest roulette wheel you have.
I love it. You're now official our James Earl Jones.
Okay, with honor, sir.
Okay. And everyone, make sure to follow David. We'll include his socials down the details below, and make sure to get involved in that auction that ends this Saturday. Yes. It's once in a lifetime opportunity. I sincerely mean that.
Absolutely.
And especially since I'll be bidding against y'all. So
exactly. Yeah. I don't see you pushing a button.
I'm being patient. It's a chess match, David.
Oh, man.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, David. Thank you for joining. We'll see you on the next one.
Thank you, guys.